Islam or what, or it was a
It was, I think,
caricature.
At the same time as the Daesh, right? If I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, well, exactly.
It was at the same time where you had this negative view about Islam because of mm-hmm. the ISIS.
And his second
letter
was... And
you had these terrorist attacks going on in France and so on.
Yeah, exactly. And his second letter was about the nonsense that the French president had to share regarding freedom of speech and the drawings and this and that. Our focus is the letter, however. And, you know, it's really interesting what you guys pointed out, that why is he talking to the youth and not to the other...
sectors of the society.
Yeah, and the age ranges. He says in his letter, interestingly enough, that I am addressing you doesn't mean I'm undermining your parents, mm-hmm. but my issue with them is on another level.
Yeah.
I want to have a heart-to-heart with you guys, you know?
Yeah.
And it was sort of like he confided to the youth, and I found it really refreshing.
Yeah, and what Sedway just said is actually mentioned in his letter. It says, I would like to talk to you about Islam, particularly the image that is presented to you as Islam. Many attempts have been made over the past two decades, the provocation of a feeling of horror and hatred, and its utilization has unfortunately a long record in the political history of the West. So it's exactly,
right.
That
I
was
would
the
like
intention.
To add, I would like to add to that, Ayatollah Khamenei, he very clearly says that you should go back to our books, our main authoritative references, to see what Islam is. Do not listen to say hearings, do not listen to people, to the mass media, whatever. Go back to our books, our reference.
Meaning the Quran and the Hadith?
The Quran and the Hadith books and other books that explain those two. Because the Quran does not talk. You have to read the interpretation of it. You have to read the interpretation of those Ahadith. But especially when it comes to Aqa'id, that is what the leader meant, I think.
The what
principles,
do you mean by Aqa'id? The theology
the principles,
of the people?
Yeah, theology, the principles of faith. What is Islam? You have to go back to the principles of faith. This is Islam. And then you have these books. And he introduced some books. So go back to the main reliable, sound books that we have. Mm-hmm. And he introduced, of course, the books that we in the school of Ahlul Bayt refer to as main sources that the youth should go back to and see for them or read for themselves. If they want to know anything about Islam, don't listen to me, Mr. Khamenei. Don't listen to this or that person, X. But go back to the books that our scholars have written and read for yourself and judge for yourselves.
Definitely.
And that is very interesting if we compare that letter with the letter of Ayatollah Khomeini, Rahmatullah Alayh, to the leader of a Soviet Union, where he said that you would face destruction. And instead of going towards capitalism, go towards spirituality. We can send a group of scholars from Qom to you guys and teach you. And after that, have those who are more acute, more clever, come and study philosophy. After that level, come and study philosophy.
And he actually mentioned philosophy?
He mentions philosophy. And then after that, the third filter, all right? There's a second filter. He says, and choose the acute among them and send them to Qom. He doesn't say, we will send you scholars here. He says, send them to Qom and let them study the books of Sheikh al-Akbar ibn Arabi, the books of great mystics. That's what he says. So other doors will open up for you guys, that there is other realms that you haven't even explored. There is more than materialism, and that is very interesting. And here, Ayatollah Khamenei says what? He doesn't refer to mysticism. He says, go back to the books of our principles, the principles of our faith.
And also one more thing that the leader discusses in his letter to the youth is that usually so much emphasis has been done on the terrorism of some so-called Muslims, you know, the terroristic acts of so-called Muslims in the West. He says, take the magnifying glass off the Muslim part of the society. And even in the West, there has been dark pages in the history of the West. For example, the slavery that was going on in the Europe and the United States, or the colonial period where, you know, people would go to India, people would go to different countries and, you know, the colonialist powers, and they would get their resources back to their country. Look at those dark pages as well. Look at the World Wars
the
One and Two.
Transatlantic slave trade. The great...
Exactly, the slave trade. Look at the...
it was horrible.
World Wars.
The World Wars. Look at the fight
Vietnam.
Between Catholics and the Protestants.
Right.
All these are dark pages of history that everybody, you guys, you so-called peace lovers in the West have had. So if you want to have a just, balanced view towards what's going on in the world, don't just zoom on one specific scene which the media has, you know, forced you to look at. Look at the larger picture so you would understand the reality in a better way.
Those are all very interesting points that you guys highlighted. And
one...
Yeah, sure.
This other, he says that, you know well that humiliation and spreading hatred and illusionary fear of the other have been the common base of all those oppressive profiteers. Now I would like you to ask yourself why the old policy of spreading phobia and hatred has targeted Islam and Muslims with an unprecedented intensity. This is a very question to ask.
Exactly.
Why Islam?
This is exactly what
why
I wanted
Shiism?
To say. Yeah, because it is the most convenient and most profiting thing for the Western world to do since its beginning. Was to, when things got rough and when they needed to, you know, get a quick funding for one of their diabolical plans, they would just push someone under the bus and sacrifice a minority for
right.
their individual gains, whether it was the Native Americans, whether it was the Asian countries and African countries that they colonized, whether it was the black minority in their country, whether it was other religions such as Muslims. That's always been their, like, go-to card, you know? Things are getting complicated for us. We need a quick change. We need to exploit the resources of a group of people who are inferior to us so that we can, behind the curtains and behind hidden doors, we can carry on with our agendas and politics to meet whatever objectives it is that we have set our minds on. And for the longest time, they were doing that with the Muslim society, whether it was in their own lands or outside of their borders. And it really begs the question, what did Muslims ever do to them? If anything, it was always white folks. I'm not trying to be racist here. I have a lot of wonderful white friends. But it was always white folks getting onto their boats and their ships and their planes and their trains.
You
and
mean?
Their, what?
Anglo-Saxons, you mean?
Yes. Getting onto their planes and their trains and their tanks and their horses and their ships and their boats, coming to the other side of the world and leeching onto
right.
Muslim countries, whether
Massacre.
It was for their gold, whether it was for their silver, whether it was for their
oil.
Copper, for their oil,
natural
for their spices,
resources.
For their tea, for their whatever, you know? There's a pattern, I feel, always in their politics. And the leader of the Islamic Revolution, through this endeavor, was trying to redirect the minds of the Muslim youth.
And, highlight.
And highlight,
those
yeah.
issues.
Redirect their minds and tell them that, guys, notice, do you guys even notice what
right.
your leaders are doing? Thank you so very much, you guys,
thank
for
you.
Your input, and thank you to our listeners for being with us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Ya Allah, ya Rabb al-alamin, ya Rahman, ya Rahim, ya Rabbi, let the ummah rise again. Ya Allah, ya Rabb al-alamin, ya Rahman, ya Rahim, ya Rabbi, let the ummah rise again, let us see daylight again. once again. Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio. Spiritual message of Islam.
His door is open no matter who you are. Just take the first step, you'll see it's not so far. If we all open our eyes to see, he is all that we need right now. And we can all come together somewhere, somehow.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. La hawla wa la quwwata illa billahi al-aliyyil azim. Alhamdulillah Rabbil Alameen wa sallallahu ala Sayyidina wa Nabiyyina Abil Qasim al-Mustafa Muhammad. Wa ala alihi al-tayyibin al-tahirin la siyama baqiyatillah fi al-aradin ajalallahu ta'ala farajahu al-sharif wa ja'alana min a'wanihi wa ansarihi wa shi'atih. We've been studying different features of the community of Ahlul Bayt alayhim salam, and after studying the necessity of being balanced, being truthful, being united, we talked about the necessity of observing the rights of each mu'min. And we said there are lots of rights that mu'minin should observe, and these are indeed to keep the community together and form a very solid, united community, like one body, as Rasulullah said, that the example of mu'minin in their love, in their sympathy, in their affection is like one jasad. مَثَلُ الْمُؤْمَنِينَ فِي تَوَادِّهِمْ وَتَرَاحُمْهِمْ وَتَعَاطُفِهِمْ كَمَثَلِ جَسَدْ. It's like one body. Different cells and organs of the same body. I want now to mention a very important hadith, and then inshallah we move on to another characteristic of the community of Ahlul Bayt, and that is to do Amr al-Ma'ruf and Nahy al-Munkar. This hadith is a very important hadith in Mustadrak. قال قلت لأبي عبد الله عليه السلام ما حق المؤمن على المؤمن. We had a hadith yesterday. Mu'alla ibn Khunais had asked Imam Sadiq, this is another hadith, what is the right of mu'min over another mu'min? Imam said, إِنَّ مِنْ حَقِّ الْمُؤْمِنَ عَلَى الْمُؤْمِنِ الْمَوَدَّةَ لَهُ فِي صَدْرِهِ. The first thing is that you should love your brothers and sisters. There must be real love in your chest for them. We are not a community that are kept close to each other because of power of force, or, you know, I don't know, because of some, you know, selfish reasons, or because we want to, you know, gain something in dunya. or like a political party. They may hate each other, but they work together for some reason. We are a community that are together because we love each other. Love for Allah and love for Ahlul Bayt has made us love each other. So the first right is to love your brothers and sisters in your heart, in your chest. وَالْمُوَاسَاتَ لَهُ فِي مَالِهِ. If you have something and your brother or sister doesn't have enough, you share. You share your money with them. وَالْخَلَفْ لَهُ فِي أَهْلِهِ. If your brother or sister travels, goes for Hajj, goes for business, is ill, admitted in hospital, for any reason he or she is absent, you look after the family, help them. So try to somehow replace and fill the gap. وَالنُّصْرَحْ لَهُ عَلَى مَنْ ظَلَمَهُ. If someone has done zulm to him, you support him. وَإِنْ كَانَ نَافِلَةً فِي الْمُسْلِمِينَ وَكَانَ غَائِبًا أَخَذَ لَهُ بِالنَّصِيبِهِ. If something is distributed, you know, for example, at that time when there was public, you know, treasury house, Baytul Mal, sometimes there were some booties, something, you know, some profits, they were dividing. So if someone was absent, was losing perhaps, there was no bank account to put in the bank account. So if there is anything which is distributed, which is good, you keep for your brother and sister.
Oh, what a wonderful world this would be if we all open our eyes to see. He is all that we need right now, and we can all come together somewhere, somehow. His door is open no matter who you are. Just take the first step, you'll see it's not so far. Down this road that holds all the answers. Open your heart to something greater. His holy book speaks pure and true, and always tells us what we must do. His last prophet was sent as a guide, an example by which we abide. There is salvation for those who seek to find the one and only source of peace and understanding of why we are here, who created us, who we must fear. So what a wonderful world this would be if we all open our eyes to see. He is all that we need right now, and we can all come together somewhere, somehow.
وَإِذَا مَاتَ الزِّيَارَ إِلَىٰ قَبْرِهِ. If he or she dies, you don't forget. Say, okay, as long as he or she is alive, you know, we are close, but then we forget. No. Even after death, we have to remember, visit them. Alhamdulillah, this community is very loyal to the dead people, and I very much appreciate that. Even in the wedding, they remember the dead people. It's very important. وَأَلَّا يَكْذِبَهُ or يُكَذِّبَهُ. Item is not to tell lies to each other or not to deny and reject each other. A mu'min doesn't tell lies to the brother and sister, and also when he speaks, doesn't say you are a liar. Believes in what he says. Of course, sometimes you take also some measure to check, you know, if there is something which has some legal impact, but you don't say you are a liar. You say, I respect what you say, but then you also do some investigation if it is needed. And then, look at this. وَأَلَّا يَقُولَ لَهُ أُفْ. You know, Allah says in the Quran, you cannot say أُفْ to your mother, to your father. What does أُفْ mean? It means to say that I am, you know, tired. I am, you know, fed up. You are boring. You are, you know, making me suffer. And our hadith says this is the least that can be said in word. Of is very slight, very gentle, but still we must not say this to our parents. And this is for all parents, whether they are Muslim, kafir, any parent, we should be very careful not to be impolite. But mu'mineen also should be very polite with each other. Mu'min has great respect. Even some hadith says the respect of Mu'min is more than Kaaba. Hurmatul Muslim, Allah's expectation from us is to have such regard for Muslim that we have for Kaaba. So you cannot say to Mu'min that I don't like you, I na'uzubillah hate you, go away, get lost. This is not what you say to Mu'min. وَإِذَا قَالَ لَهُ أُفْ فَلَيْسَ بَيْنَهُمَا وِلَايَةٌ. If you say to Mu'min off, then your wilaya is finished. Because between Mu'mineen, there is wilaya that connects them with each other and with Allah and Ahlul Bayt. Al-Mu'minun wal-Mu'minat ba'duhum awliya'u ba'd. Mu'mineen are wali for each other. They are guardians for each other. If a Mu'min says bad things, bad words to his brother and sister, and says, I hate you, I don't like you, I don't want to see you anymore, then the wilaya is finished.
I'm looking back throughout the years to breathe as hard, and my eyes are choked with tears. Your face and hair are full of light, now it will soon be time to go. I feel you feeling calm now. Did the angel let you know?
Oh Allah, please send your salutations to Muhammad and all Muhammad. Oh Allah, please forgive us. Please forgive all our sins and mistakes and shortcomings. Please enable us to serve you with full honesty and truthfulness and sincerity. Please include us among the best followers of Muhammad and Ali Muhammad. Please protect and safeguard our community and our families and our youths from everything that you don't like. Oh Allah, please hasten the reappearance of Imam Zaman Ajjalallahu Ta'ala Farajahu Sharif. Please make our Imam Zaman happy with what we do and what we say. Please answer his du'as for his faraj. Please give shifa to all people who are ill. Please give shifa to people who are ill in their body and in their soul. Oh Allah, please send your rahmah, your forgiveness to all who have passed away, especially brothers and sisters who were attending these majalis in this community and other communities. Our parents, our foreparents, our teachers, our ulama, our maraje, those who have passed away, please let them be with Muhammad and Ali Muhammad right now. And please give long life and blessed life to the parents and to the teachers and maraja who are alive. Oh Allah, please make the last moment of our life the best moment of our life. Wa akhiru da'wana and alhamdulillahi rabbil alameen.
That was the Characters of Shia Community by Hujjatul Islam, Dr. Shomali, in the program The Spiritual Message of Islam.
My Ummah, he will say, Rasulullah on that day, even though we've strayed from him and his way. My brothers, my sisters in Islam, let's struggle, work and pray. If we are to bring back the glory of his way. Ya Allah, Ya Rabb al-Alameen, Ya Rahman, Ya Rahim, Ya Rabbi, let the Ummah rise again.
Ya Allah,
Ya Rabb al-Alameen, Ya Rahman, Ya Rahim, Ya Rabbi, let the Ummah rise again. Let us see daylight again, once again. Let's become.
Ministry.
Four
42 years have passed since the people of Iran took to the streets and brought about the Islamic Revolution of 1979 under the leadership of Ayatollah Imam Ruhollah Khomeini. Today, it is a proven fact that the 1979 Islamic Revolution created great hope among the deprived nations throughout the world. What were the main factors which led to the Islamic Revolution, you may ask? A society torn between tradition and Western modernity, poverty and prosperity, dictatorship, and a yearning for democracy. The reasons are countless, but to answer the question in full, one should not look at the 1979 revolution as an isolated incident. Rather, it was the culmination of over a century's strive to end the dictatorial powers of monarchs, remove foreign influences from Iranian politics, distribute wealth while ensuring both economic prosperity and allow for central guidance and control, and to create a constitution that was both democratic and would not alienate the traditional and religious portion of the population. The world was surprised and astonished by the Iranian Revolution, which was led by Ayatollah Ruhollah Khomeini in exile from Paris. The personality of Iran's Ayatollah Khomeini was a critical element in redefining Iran's role in the region. Imam Khomeini's background, charisma, and thirst for revolting for the people of Iran influenced the atmosphere leading to the revolution. One can understand Khomeini's personality and beliefs by examining his background. His devotion to Islam, reflected by his simplistic, austere lifestyle focused on spiritual matters, attracted the majority of Iranian society, which was stricken with poverty. Many of these traditional citizens flocked to the modern cities seeking opportunity, only to wind up crowded into slums. Imam Khomeini's life of suffering and final return to Iran replicated a legacy of the oppressed experience. Imam Khomeini unwaveringly opposed monarchy, arguing that only rule by a leading Islamic jurist would ensure that the true Islamic ruling was properly followed. Imam Khomeini's novel artistry was seen in the way that he took the corrupted system that had been ruling the country and replaced it with a political system of service to the people rather than ignoring them. Welcome to the Middle East Stream. I'm Mara Osman. The story of the Iranian Revolution is not similar to the story of other revolutions in the 20th century, as the wave of Islamic revolution swept away the Shah's corrupt regime and brought a new political discourse which cannot be categorized either as a communist or a capitalist. It was, and always will be, an Islamic revolution. To discuss this issue with us from Beirut is Mr. Mohammed Abed, political commentator. Thank you for being with us, Mohammed. Now, just how major was the impact of the revolution that saw the ouster of Iran's king of that time, Shah Mohammad Reza Pahlavi, and the beginning of the era of Ayatollah Sayyid Ruhollah Khomeini as the supreme leader of the Islamic Republic of Iran?
Well, first of all, you have to take a look at the whole region in general, and you will understand all these changes that took place throughout these 40 years. At that time, you had the major conflict, which is still here up till now, which is the Arab-Israeli conflict. At the time when Israel was the so-called invincible army, at the time when they used to launch the Israeli occupation, used to launch any aggression whenever they wanted at any Arab country. They reached up till Tunisia and other faraway countries like Sudan. Now we see that Israel, the occupation entity, right now is a besieged entity that is surrounded by rockets and missiles that are really spreading fear among the Zionist settlers. And all this is due to the policy which was adopted by the Islamic Revolution in Iran. I mean, the creation of a strategy of patience that took the long run into consideration, not rather very easily achieved the victories, but rather ones that took some time in order to be achieved. And I mean, this brought a shift and a major upside down, if you will, change in the strategic equation in the region. You saw the aggressor, now we see the aggressor, which used to take freedom in launching any aggression wherever they wanted, are now besieged even by the Gaza Strip. They cannot even launch an aggression on Gaza without taking thousands of calculations into consideration. So this is one of the major shifts that I see, Dean, that are very important and are the outcome of the Islamic Revolution and the Islamic Republic.
Well, four decades later after the revolution, in what aspect is this Islamic Revolution in Iran still mostly visible while the country still suffers from the fiercest economic and political sanctions that has ever hit a sovereign nation?
Well, also to take a logical course in this domain, look, in spite of all these economic sanctions and all this blockade against the Islamic Republic, you see that it is the major strategic power in the region, whereas other countries, such as Saudi Arabia, such as the United Arab Emirates and others, are not taken into consideration when it comes to the major players in the region and at the international level. You do not see, for instance, the United States minding the whatever the Saudis are saying, whereas you see every move and every act taken by the Islamic Republic of Iran is minded and is taken into analysis and so in the whole region. So this is one example. I know because of the shortage of time, we cannot discuss this very in a very long way, but this serves as a good example that in spite of all these sanctions, in spite of all that sort of punishment that mm-hmm. was being targeted the Islamic Republic due to its political stances and due to its support to the oppressed throughout the region, mainly those related to the Arab-Israeli conflict, you see that Israel is that the Islamic Republic is being punished for that. But still, one major lesson that can be learned to all the revolutions that are to come throughout history is that the Iranians have been supreme teachers in teaching the world how to turn a challenge into an opportunity. They have used these sanctions in order to develop their industries, to develop ways of
this is what I want to discuss further, because what you said is it falls on the on the shoulders of merchants, on traders, intellectuals, urban masses who played a grave role in the success of the Islamic Revolution led by Ayatollah Sayyid Ruhollah Khomeini. These categories of citizens have suffered the most under this current wave of sanctions and the sanctions that have been there for the past 40 years, because the West believes that for a regime change to work in Iraq, in Iran, they have to target these specific categories and suffocate them as much as possible. How do you think this plan have worked so far?
Well, this is not new to the arrogant powers. Whenever they cannot achieve any triumph while dealing with the major opponents, I mean the government of Iran or the leadership in Iran, they turn to the weaker side. They try to target the as you said, the merchants, the other, the ordinary people in the street. We have seen this also in Lebanon. Now, mm-hmm. when they cannot achieve any victories against the Islamic resistance, they turn to suffocating at the economic level all the Lebanese people in order to turn into a phase when the whole Lebanese people, and hopefully, and I'm sure this, inshallah, will never happen, that the whole Lebanese people would turn to the accusation to the Islamic resistance that you are the reason why we are falling this. Now, the Iranians, and in a very clever step in this regard, have always focused on insight, on the well-awareness of the whole factors and elements of the conflict. It has become clear that to all the people in Iran and Lebanon, all over the region, that if you give up to the demands of the oppressors, to the arrogant powers, the United States basically, you will have to pay a larger price than the one you are paying when you are steadfast and you are standing up against those challenges. So that's why this sort of answers this question that those merchants, one way or another, know that if the Americans come to control the region, to control Iran, they are going to absorb and use all their resources of the country, and this the merchants will and all the Iranian citizens will be paying the price to that. So the creation of this insight among the people of the Islamic Republic has been also fruitful and has been successful in this regard.
Well, we have less than 2 minutes. I want to ask you about the continued development and actually the impressive industrial progress in Iran, despite the sanctions. But it is conveying a message to the world that Iran will never stop its development and its prosperity while simultaneously resisting the U.S. vicious plots in the region. But in that regard, a lot has been said about Iran's nuclear program. How do you think Iran will maneuver around this that's supposedly a very large red flag by the West?
Yes, they have been doing this successfully for over 20 years now. They have been dealing with the threats. They have been dealing with the any good or signs of rapprochement, if you will, from the other from the Western world with similar steps. So there is no fear on this. But once again, I have to repeat this issue of the creation of the human being that is willing to stand up against any challenge in order to develop at the nuclear level, at the other levels of industrial and a few weeks ago, I think a new car was manufactured in Iran, a new model. So you see, the sanctions have not been able to achieve their goal of creating despair in the people of Iran.
Well, we still have to see how this supposed rapprochement, if it will happen, and how it will happen. I want to thank you very much, Mohammed Abed, political commentator, for joining us from Beirut to talk about the effect of the Islamic revolution inside of Iran. Thank you for being with us. Please stay tuned. We will continue this matter about how the revolution affected the region after the break.
This is Midstream, and here is IRIB English Radio. Dear listeners, in this weekly program, Marwa Osman discusses two important issues related to West Asia region with two political analysts. Midstream is with you every Friday on IRIB English Radio.
The victory of the Islamic Revolution in Iran revived high hopes in the region of West Asia, especially for the Palestinian people and the Lebanese people who suffered from the existence of Israel, specifically that Imam Khomeini's position from Israel was clear from the very beginning. The Islamic Revolution became the main force facing the Zionist project in the region and the main backer of the Palestinian liberation movements while helping create a regional power of allied resistance forces. From a revolution to a regional force in this following report.
Israel invaded Beirut in 1982 and drove the Palestinian resistance fighters out of Lebanon. There was fear of a coming horror and new alienation. Almost everything would have fallen apart had it not been for a few heroes who kept their fingers on the trigger in the face of what was defined as absolute evil. For so long, the Israeli entity thought that in its war on Lebanon, it would push its last opponents to surrender, which paves the way for scripting a new history for the region. However, its endeavor was faltered by a group of few men back then with a strength which came solely from faith that was later sponsored by a man who believed that the main confrontation with powers ruining the region could not take place until after the fall of the Shah of Iran, and as he said, happened. The Islamic Republic of Iran translated the words of its leader into action, sponsoring the first resistance force in Lebanon and later in Palestine with training, weapons, and funding until the victory of Lebanon was achieved and liberation was attained. Lebanon's victory was a good news for all oppressed countries, organizations, and individuals, as it increased steadfastness and determination in the path of what one aspires to in terms of glory and elevation, the realization of independence, freedom, and the establishment of justice. From Baghdad to Damascus, Beirut, Gaza, and Sana'a, passing through the oppressed nations of Bahrain and Hejaz, this yearn for social justice and liberation and the formation of an allied force of resistance across the region of West Asia would not have been possible without the support of those who believed in standing with the vulnerable in the face of the arrogant. It is what the essence of the revolution of Imam Ruhullah al-Khomeini was all about. The Islamic Revolution of 1979, which brought about the emergence of the Islamic Republic of Iran, became the awakening of the peoples of our region and beyond. The Islamic Republic of Iran's model of confrontation with imperialism has challenged the U.S. and its puppet Israeli regime in the region and across the entire world to such a degree that Iran's strategic influence in the form of an allied forces of resistance has become the U.S. and the Zionist regime's biggest concern.
To discuss this issue with us from London is Shabir Hassan Ali, political commentator. Thank you for being with us. Shabir, now, since its inception, the Islamic Republic of Iran has challenged the world's corrupt political system and created new political spaces that enabled the oppressed, for example, the oppressed Palestinians, to resist the American imperialism and the Zionist occupation. This has been a very long and bumpy ride in the region. How far will this be going with the current wave of regional normalization with the Israeli entity?
I think, first of all, the normalization will not make any difference. The normalization has always really been there. It's not something new. It's now just formalized. The resistance factions on the ground are alien to the occupiers that occupy them. For example, if you look at the countries of so-called UAE or so-called Saudi or so-called Bahrain, these countries are not ruled by their own people. They're ruled by imports, people who have no connection to the actual land and are purely working for the Zionists, the same way that Palestine is occupied by European Zionists. This is the same game. So in reality, the normalization, I don't think, will make any real difference. What it will do is it will make things a lot clearer in many ways. And it will hasten the demise of these entities like so-called Saudi Arabia, so-called Bahrain, so-called UAE, and all of these, as well as, of course, the parent of them, which is the Zionist entity occupying Palestine. And I think the important thing that we need to understand is what Iran is doing is not something particularly strange or particularly problematic. From a global perspective, it shouldn't be seen in this way. Because if you look at all of the global countries, people have alliances. This is something that's been there from like history, from ancient history. Mm-hmm. People from different countries, they make alliances, and they work together to try and better their lot. Now, if the countries that are making alliances are occupied by third parties who have no space there, then at the end of the day, a responsible country like Iran will make an alliance with the actual people on the ground, which is really what the country is. The country is not made up of these one or two families. It's made up of the actual people on the ground.
This is actually what scares the Western regime, because they extensively condemned the regional coordination that the Islamic Republic of Iran was able to achieve along with the allied forces of the resistance in all of West Asia, to a point that once surrounded Iran has now allies that have encircled the presence of the colonialists, the presence of the occupiers in the region. This led to a maximum campaign, pressure campaign of sanctions for everyone, including the allied forces of the resistance, not only for the Islamic Republic of Iran. How much do you think this will damage the performance of the regional allied forces of the resistance in West Asia?
I think if we look at the policy of sanctions, maximum pressure or otherwise, it's actually more damaging to the party making the sanctions. In the case of Iran and the resistance axis, the sanctions have been more damaging to America and to the West because they have lost a very, very important market for which they can do trade. As for Iran and the resistance axis, yes, of course, there is a short-term pain. But ultimately, it forces people to be reliant on themselves. And like Khamenei has said, and even said Hassan has said, we need to start relying on ourselves. We need to stop relying on the outside. And at the end of the day, the allies that the resistance axis has got, such as China, such as Russia, these are the powerhouses of trade in the world. Like China, everything is made in China. You know, from the most amazing things that America claims are its own, nothing is actually made in America. America is useless in terms of manufacture. Mm-hmm. Everything is made in China, and China is friends with the resistance axis. So even though these sanctions with the extraterritorial components and all of this talk of maximum pressure and all of this, really, this is only valid from a PR perspective. In reality, while there is pain for the people on the ground, I'll not say there isn't pain,
mm-hmm.
What it will do is when you push a person hard, ultimately what will happen is that person will say, well, okay, fine, there's no point me trying to negotiate with you because you're just not interested. Mm-hmm. I will go and make this myself, or I will deal with people who will deal with me.
Well, this is exactly what happened in the region, because we saw the emergence of Hezbollah in Lebanon to face the Israeli aggression. We saw the moral boost that was provided to the popular mobilization units in Iraq by the Islamic Republic, and the regional Cold War against both Saudi Arabia, to be honest with you, and also the Israeli regime. We had lending an Islamic flavor to the anti-imperialist sentiment in West Asia as a whole, and even openly challenging Western foreign policy by giving aid to Latin American countries, for example, like Venezuela. How can one explain this smooth flow of inspiration from the Islamic Revolution to cultures that are not even Islamic?
I think what we have to understand about the Islamic Revolution is while it was Islamic, it was actually a global revolution of the oppressed against the oppressor. And Imam Khomeini mentioned this many times in many of his speeches, that anyone who sees themselves oppressed at the hand of the empire, at the hand of the powers of global arrogance or Zionism, they will all come together. Because, for example, if you take Venezuela, Venezuela has been hammered really badly. Cuba, even, has been hammered very badly by America just for wanting to be different, just for daring to be, to follow a different political ideology and to not allow the infection of American capitalism and its various tentacles, if you like.
Simply for wanting to be sovereign nations.
Exactly. They want their sovereignty. And America doesn't want people to be sovereign. America wants people to be beholden to the empire. And when other countries see someone who is like a standard bearer, a flag bearer, for this movement of anti-imperialism, anti-arrogance, they all sort of come together, because good people generally come together. We may have differences in terms of our religious beliefs and all of this, but in terms of the ideology against imperialism, mm-hmm. and against oppression, everyone is on the same page. And that also lets people discuss later on religious ideas and find commonalities in all of this.
Mm-hmm. Well, I have less than 2 minutes, but I want to discuss what the Biden administration might bring forward to the table in the region of West Asia, because they are sending sort of vague messages. They want to rapprochement, but at the same time, they are increasing their military maneuvers in both Iraq and Syria. They're even again, backing ISIS and Daesh and Al-Qaeda in Syria and in Iraq. They're targeting popular mobilization unit bases as well. It is obvious that also the current leader of the revolution, Imam Sayyid Ali Khamenei, is suspicious of the American intentions. Do you think the region is moving towards negotiations or just a huge explosion?
I don't think there's going to be any negotiations. America has clearly said that they're not willing to reduce any of their sanctions or do anything from their side in order to encourage Iran to, have, as a show of good faith. I think ultimately what they will do is just like what Obama did. They will manufacture and they will feed things like Daesh with a means to try and break the region further and cause more problems. But I think this time, the damage that will be done to the empire will be very serious.
Mm-hmm.
And it will end up leaving and taking its lapdogs like the Saudis and the Israelis out of the region. It won't be easy, but I think that, as they say, you can see the light at the end of the tunnel.
Well, I want to thank you very much, Shabir Hassan Ali, political commentator, for joining us from London to talk about how the Islamic Revolution led by Imam Ruhollah Khomeini affected the entire world, not only West Asia. Thank you for being with us. And thank you. Please stay tuned next week for more from the Middle East Stream.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked.
The Holy Prophet of Islam is the example.
Self purification is the most significant
factor.
Imamate is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, assalamu alaikum, dear brothers and sisters in faith. Welcome to the program, Ulama Speech. In today's program, we're going to listen to the English translation of a short speech by Ayatollah Misbah Yazdi. Please stay tuned.
بخوام تمدن اسلامی داشته باشیم قدم اولش اینه که مبانی فکریش رو درست بفهمیم.
If we want to have an Islamic civilization, the first step is to understand our intellectual fundamentals properly. Because if it doesn't possess a root, then, and the parable of the bad words is that of a bad tree, uprooted from the ground, it has no stability. The Holy Quran, Surah 14, Ayah 26. So, for a proper Islamic civilization to exist, the right culture of Islam and the correct beliefs are a requirement. And then the other sciences that can help achieve these goals that we mentioned. And therefore, we say that the most important element of the true Islamic revolution was the cultural element. Perhaps it is primarily the cultural element. Other elements are a consequence of the system being an Islamic system. May Allah resurrect the soul of the Imam Khomeini with the prophets and the saints. May Allah resurrect our martyrs with the martyrs of Karbala. May Allah protect the shadow of the great leader, Imam Khomeini, over us. Despite the adversity, ignorance that we possess, may Allah increase the blessings in His existence. Thank you so much, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, for listening to this episode of Ulama Speech. which was the English translation of a short speech by Ayatollah Misbah Yazdi. Until next time, we leave you in Allah's care.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Supplication is the wealth of the believer and the bridge by which one achieves proximity to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, the Exalted.
A path to salvation, a way to connect the two worlds. On the program, Bridge.
You're listening to the program Bridge on IRIB English Radio with Sheikh Muhammad Mahmoud Khalfan, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
A'udhu billahi min ash-shaytanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Wa bihi nasta'in. Wa sallallahu ala Muhammad wa alihi at-tayyibin at-tahirin al-ma'sumin. Salamun alaykum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Dear brothers and sisters in Islam, welcome once again to yet another episode of The Bridge, a program in which we try to discuss the different supplications of Imam Zainul Abidin alayhi salam, supplications that have come in the form of a prayer manual known as As-Sahifatu Sajjadiyya. We have been discussing the seventh supplication of this prayer manual, and that is on Imam Sajjad alayhi salam's dua during incidents of sorrow, painful occasions, and intense grief. We were discussing verse number 6, and inshallah today we will look at the next verse, which is verse number 7. In verse number 6, if you remember, we talked about the reality that it is by Allah's qudrah and it's by Allah's power that He brings to the people what they encounter. So whatever calamities that befall, whatever unpleasant circumstances come about, it is by Allah's power that all these circumstances come about, and it is through His sovereignty that things transpire. No one has the power, it is only Allah who has the power. Now, having known this principle, the next verse is like a corollary of the previous verse. In this verse, we confess Imam Zainul Abidin alayhi salam informs us or teaches us how to confess the reality that because all the power belongs to Allah, Imam Zain al-Abidin alayhi salam say,
فَلَا مُصْدِرَ لِمَا أَوْرَدْ وَلَا صَارِفَ لِمَا وَجَّهْتْ وَلَا فَاتِحَ لِمَا أَغْلَقْتْ وَلَا مُغْلِقَ لِمَا فَتَحْتْ وَلَا مُيَسِّرَ لِمَا